Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With COVID, what we really started to understand was that a lot of children get all of their food at school. And so as a first priority, like cleaning up the act of the government, what the government's providing for school. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunt you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. And for the first time today, we have got on a mother-daughter duo. They are the co-founders of the company Step It Up. They are helping people to get in better shape. And this is Helene and Penelope. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so I've done a brief intro there. I know who you both are. I've met you before. But for people who are not familiar with yourselves, please introduce yourselves.
I'm Penelope, and I used to be 300 pounds, and I've lost 140 pounds since, and it inspired me to start this weight loss company with my mom, Helene.
I'm Helene Leeds, and I co-founded this company with Penelope. She founded it really when she was 11, and I've been helping people to get healthy for the last almost 30 years. Weight loss has been in the realm of what I do, but more it's about energy. That's really what ends up being the big thing that people get after working with me. But I have a real interest in functional medicine, in food as medicine. I've traveled the world studying food as medicine. I have a bachelor's and a master's degree in nutrition. I have built culinary programs for institutes, organizations, universities. I've written ghostwritten cookbooks. I've written cookbooks. I was on MasterChef. Like, I'm really into food. And I'm really into movement. I have over 20,000 hours in yoga therapy. And I am really into the truth about health, because the Western system kind of failed me. And then I had to figure it out for myself.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. You said that the Western system failed you. You said that you used to be over 300 pounds. So you've both obviously had a journey to get into the world of health. Can you tell me a little bit more about the backstory?
Yeah, my mom was obese. So I was in Weight Watchers at age 5. My mom was morbidly obese and died, actually, with her third cause of death as obesity, severe obesity. So just witnessing that as a young child, having, you know, hundreds of pounds gained and lost, is pretty intense when you think about it, just from a child's perspective. And she was an Overeaters Anonymous, so the 12-step program was on the kitchen table. So I was really aware as a young child what it was like to, you know, have food compulsive eating disorder, to have like food as a celebration and also as a suffering, you know, and so on and so forth. So it was a really strong dynamic that was put into my life early on.
Okay. And what about you, Penelope?
I was overweight my whole life, actually, like always a little overweight. And it didn't happen until we moved to California, which was like our fourth move. And I went to this public school. It was my first time going to public school. And everyone there was very, very skinny. And I was kind of like really sticking out like a sore thumb. And everyone told me that it was okay to be overweight and that it was fine. And all my friends were encouraging me to eat junk food. And I had a 7-Eleven at the bottom of my hill. And I actually would walk down the bottom of my hill, go to 7-Eleven, eat all the chips and donuts that I was never allowed to eat because my mom's a health fanatic. That was never in the house ever. So even since I was a little girl, I was eating like 5 boxes of pizza and like 3 bags of chips. And it was just something I would do like in private and hiding. But it got so bad, I started stealing money from her. And then I was eating junk food behind her back and shoving it in the closet and hiding it in trash cans and bins outside. I was so like, I was just so addicted to food. And then as I gained more and more weight, like it started coming on really fast. COVID had started to happen, and I was so depressed and so anxious, I had to switch schools, actually, because I was gaining so much weight, and I had so many more health issues as a, you know, side effect of gaining the weight. So I had panic attacks in the hallways. I was, you know, depressed and anxious. I was even suicidal. I remember looking up how to kill myself on the internet because I was like so like sad and so with myself and my body. I wore potato sacks. Like I would just wear like sweatpants and sweatshirts, and I like didn't care about my self image at all. Like didn't care about makeup, didn't care about my hair. And then I had therapists and doctors telling me that it was okay to be overweight, that I was beautiful, and that there was nothing wrong with me. And I believed them. My friends fed me fried Oreos. The only person who told me the truth is my mother, who no one likes listening to their parents. And I hated her for telling me that I was like needed to get off my butt and open my curtains because all I wanted to do was sit in my room and vape and not move my body. But I knew that I had to. And so when COVID hit, I had to see myself every day in the mirror. And that was hard because I had to see someone who was really ugly and someone who just wasn't me. Like it didn't represent who I really was. And one day I was just like, oh my gosh, this is not me. I don't even recognize this person in the mirror. I can't believe this is what I look like. I've like let myself go so far. I don't even like recognize myself. And that was like the day that I decided I needed to lose the weight, despite what social media and the body positivity movement told me. Because even on social media, people were like, oh, it's fine to be overweight. You're beautiful. There's nothing wrong with you. Like being big is beautiful. And I believe that. I truly believe that so much to the point where I was taking selfies some days. I was taking selfies of myself and being like, oh, I'm so cute and I'm so gorgeous, even though I was over 300 pounds and couldn't even go up the steps. So it was like a really tough battle that I had to go through all the time. And then one day when I realized I literally deleted social media off of my devices for 2 years, and I just grinded and lost 140 pounds in 18 months. But it took so much discipline and consistency to like get off social media so it wasn't a distraction, work out every day so that I didn't have a choice or an option to be lazy, you know, wake up early every morning so that I had to work out, so that I had to do something with my time, and then eat better, which was, that's like a whole other story we'll get into.
Well, it was really sheer desperation, you know, from a mother's perspective. Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
The doctor is saying, like, don't talk to her about it. It's going to cause more of a problem. The therapist is saying, don't talk about it. You are the problem.
Wow.
And so it's like, as a mother of an obese teen, which I'm sure there are a lot out there, there wasn't much support available. I mean, the school tried what they could. The therapist did what she could. We had group therapy. I mean, I had no idea what to do.
Yeah.
And it was really like a moment of desperation. And we're like, we're gonna step it up. And that's,
what did that feel like as a mother?
Completely helpless and hopeless. And I thought I dodged the bullet. Like, I grew up in this paradigm where my nickname was Fatso, and my mother died at 59. She doesn't even have a grandmother. And I felt completely desperate. Like, I thought I had dodged this bullet. I got a bachelor's and a master's degree in nutrition. I studied food as medicine. I studied nutritional psychology. Like, I've helped thousands of people lose weight and regain their health, and my own daughter. Like, this is ridiculous. You know, like, you try your best as a parent, but this was just really a moment of desperation. And really, I had to get real. I had to really look in the mirror, and I had to look into my heart, and I had to look at like the subconscious patterning that she was actually bringing to light. And that was some deep work. And it took me facing some demons and getting deeper into my ability to accept what was and still hold the possibility of her making the changes that were required for her life, frankly. And it was spiritual, it was mental, it was emotional. But I actually had to really do the work because it was like she was showing me something that I didn't see, I couldn't see.
Yeah. How transparent were the conversations between you two at the time? Because you were saying you were hiding food in places and sneaking off to places. And I mean, that's one of those, it's one of those habits where the results are visible, right? So there are habits that you can genuinely hide, and you can do things, and no one, if you don't talk about it, no one sees it, no one knows it. But something like that, it's weight's coming from somewhere.
And she won't let me help her, right?
Yeah.
And so, true. And no, it was pretty transparent. I mean, I was kind of a mess. I mean, it was messy.
I remember going on DoorDash and ordering like junk food and like hiding it from you. Like the DoorDash person would come, I'd grab the box and then like run to my room, and he'd be like,
drug addict baby.
Yeah, you'd be. It's so true, Zuby. Food is just, I think it's even worse than drugs because you have to literally face food every day of your life. But with drugs, you can cold turkey and never see it again. But with food, you can't do that.
Well, then the hippocampal pathway, like the brain, the neurobiology of it, of addiction isn't that much different, right? It isn't any different. And you put, you know, herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, you put additives, preservatives, chemicals in the food, you put that in your body, and the highly palatable foods, high in fat, sugar, and carbs, you're going to shift your brain into addiction. Mm. And those bacteria that are in your gut microbiome are calling out for more of it. So it is very similar.
Yeah. I'm curious about the what was going on in your mind psychologically during this period. I mean, what's the time period? So you said you started to lose weight in 2020?
It was 2020, right?
Yeah.
2019, 2020, yeah.
2019, 2020.
It was just before COVID because we put you in that special school because you wouldn't go to school.
Right.
Your social anxiety and your anxiety had gotten so bad. It was pre-COVID.
And was that because of your...
It was because of my weight. Okay. I didn't have any of these problems until I started gaining weight. And so when I started eating massive amounts of sugar and flour and started gaining weight like weekly, then I started getting depressed and anxious. People at school were like cutting themselves and doing like self-harm. So I literally did the same thing just to fit in as I was gaining weight.
Okay.
I had so much anxiety. I couldn't even leave the house. Like she's saying, I didn't even show up to school. I missed 120 days of school in eighth grade. And legit panic attacks, like I said, in the hallway, like everyone could hear me in high school. It was so embarrassing. And it was all because of the food. Like I literally swear it was.
Yeah.
Because once I lost the weight, all of these problems went away.
And sleep apnea.
I couldn't, like, I had like panic attacks in my sleep, basically.
You couldn't even go upstairs.
I couldn't even go up the steps. I went to a school that had like, I don't know, how many flights of stairs do you think there were? I don't know. There was at least like 10 flights of stairs to get to my room that I was stuck in with a bunch of depressed people who were put there because they were so depressed and sad. And I had to walk up those flights of 10 stairs and I couldn't even get up one. I had to go every day and I couldn't even get up
just
one
getting, flight.
Just getting out of breath. Getting out of the car was hard. Mm. Getting out of bed was that was a workout. Like, why would anyone want to live that way? I always ask myself, why would people want to live this way? Or why would people preach to live this way? Because it's, like, on Body Positive, they never showed me that side. Like, there were never, ever videos, and I still don't see videos online on social media. Like, this is the negative side of being overweight. This is the struggle I have being overweight every day. No one talks about it. But if they did, like, if I saw that when I was gaining the weight, I might have for a second been like, wow. Okay, maybe I don't want to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're overweight, it's hard to see past these things because you're kind of brainwashed. You kind of brainwashed yourself into thinking everything's fine and I am beautiful. Like some people do brainwash themselves into that. And that movement, the body positivity movement, brainwashing people to think that about themselves doesn't help the person who's already addicted to food. It's kind of, yeah.
Wow, I have so many thoughts here. I'm wondering how controversial to go.
Go as far as you want.
It's Real Talk with Zuby. I have some assumptions. I don't want to make assumptions, so I'm going to just ask questions. All of these people who were enabling and encouraging this behavior, I assume it was all female.
It was all female.
Why do you think that is?
I think women want to sabotage women. Like I said, when my friends were feeding me junk food, it was girls who were skinnier than me. When I was skinny, they were feeding me junk food, and then they kept on feeding me junk food.
When you say they were feeding you, I have this image in my brain. I'm trying to, as in, they weren't eating it, and they were just giving you food?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, like, they'd make the fried Oreos. They'd be like, oh, I'm not hungry, but here you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they just cook up some fried Oreos?
Whatever, their family was eating fried Oreos. Okay. They'd bring it from the kitchen and be like, here's some.
That's a thing here? People just
cook
fried Oreos?
This was in Marin.
Marin.
NorCal.
North California.
So just north of San Francisco.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Carry on. I'm intrigued as to why you think psychologically young women do that to other young women.
Well, because they see women as competition. And so, for example, from my personal perspective and opinion, like a lot of girls would, yes, be really mean to me, but then they'd also do the enabling behaviors to get me to be uglier. In my opinion, girls don't want the best for each other in today's society. Mm. And they were feeding me the junk food and telling me it was okay because they didn't care. Or they didn't want to hurt my feelings. But I don't feel like they didn't want to hurt my feelings because they were helping me and enabling my addiction. And they always told me I was pretty. My friends told me I was pretty when I was so ugly and sick. Mm. It wasn't the fact that I was just ugly and fat. It was also the fact that I was sick and I had a food addiction.
And then when you lost the weight, the girls were equally as mean.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk to me.
So there were these three girls who were, one of the girls is actually overweight herself, okay? She was overweight herself, okay? And the other three girls were very slim. And when I went to Hawaii, when I was, this was my peak weight, like 320 pounds. And when I went to go see these girls, they made me, like, I literally felt awkward next to them because I knew they were looking at me differently and judging me, as they should, as they can. I now that I've lost the weight, I can see, I'm glad they did that because that really also showed me, like, there's something wrong with me. But at the time, I was really uncomfortable around them because they were perfect. And I was like, gosh, I wish I could be you. I'm so uncomfortable in my skin and body. And then after I lost the weight, they messaged me, looking at my body positive content. They're like, you've changed so much. I can't believe it. Like, how dare you preach this message? You've changed. You're terrible. And I'm like, you guys. And the overweight girl had the nerve to say, my waist is probably smaller than you, and I'm probably more athletic than you. I've just achieved this 140-pound weight loss triumph, and you're telling me that you're better than me, skinnier than me, prettier than me, after I've made this huge triumph. I literally couldn't believe my eyes. And that's not body positive. That's not equality. I mean, this is what she preaches, but this is not what she was giving me at all. And I'm like, you're hating me for my body, for my story, which makes no sense. I get so much hate for my story and my personal beliefs, but it's the story I went through. Like, I'm allowed to share that.
And all that hate also comes from women.
Yes, all of it from women. I have not had a single guy.
Oh, I had assumptions. I'm just like, let me make sure my assumptions are.
They're all women. Yeah. All of them.
It's so fascinating. Well, I do want to say congratulations on 140-pound weight loss.
Thank you.
That's phenomenal.
Thank you.
And keeping it off. That's also awesome. It's I always tell people with weight loss that it's simple, but it's not easy. It's simple, but it's not rocket science how to lose weight on a basic level. But yeah, doing the thing and sticking with it when you have so many societal, cultural, chemical forces working against you, sadly, in this part of the world, it's difficult. It's increasingly difficult for people. I mean, you can see it in the numbers. You can hear it when you talk to people. I know a lot of people who have gained weight, lost weight, tried to all of it. And it's strange when something that sort of should just be normal becomes an uphill battle. And we're now living in a time and a place, perhaps for the first time in human history and in the first places in human history, where the problem is calories and food being so abundant and being so cheap and affordable and available. Almost all of human history, the problem was a lack, right? It was, oh, there's not enough food to go around. We need to prepare for famine. You have zero obesity levels. You've literally got some people dying of starvation, malnutrition, and all this. And now it's all so abundant. Calories have never been cheaper. So we have a weird society where people are often very overweight or even obese, yet they can still have malnutrition because they're consuming so much, but there's so much junk, and you've got big pharma, and you've got big food, and you've got the advertising agencies, and you've got social media, and you've got people who are telling you, oh, you can be healthy at any size, big is beautiful, and so on. And yeah, it's quite an uphill battle. And I think depending on your personality type, it can be somewhat easy to navigate or seemingly impossible to navigate. I do have a question. I've said a lot here, but I want to kind of stick.
System's rigged.
It is, yeah. I want to stick to the topic here because I'm curious to get into the psychology because, as I said, this is kind of a new problem. So a lot of what you described, I have heard this and I've seen some of it on the internet, but it's also very different from my experience when I was in school or my experience simply being a man. It's going to be a very, there's no body positivity for men. I always make that point.
Actually, there's this one guy who's been doing it lately.
It's not going to work though. It won't work on men.
Oh, I hope not.
No, it won't. I bet you most of his followers and acolytes will still be women.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah. And I want to know, like, why do you think that is? You've talked about female intersexual competition. But do you think there's anything else that's going on there?
I'm not going to say what I want to say about that, really what I would say is that women are more emotional.
Okay.
And women are, I would say they don't think through actions as much. So for example, I don't feel like a man would necessarily say, oh, yeah, let's go be fat, let's go gain weight, and let's go show it online and make everyone tell everyone it's okay. Mm. I don't think a man would do that. Why? Because that's not helping society. It doesn't help people's health, and it's not good for people. So logically, that's what would go through a man's head. But for a woman, you know, women like to think and say, oh, I'm beautiful, it doesn't matter, and make everyone feel better, even if it's going to harm them. Because, like I said, competition, sure, but also because they don't think through things as much as men do. And I genuinely think we act out of emotion instead of acting out of logic. And when we do that, we cause all these issues. And so when you have a pattern, women follow what they think is right. Mm-hmm. And if you have a very emotional woman, she's going to follow someone who says, oh, I'm beautiful. Women chase beauty. Well, if this is the new beauty standard that people are creating, oh, maybe I should listen to them. Oh, maybe I will fall for that. Oh, maybe they're right. If they don't have a good man in their life that's leading them to the right place, then they're going to fall into that trap.
Interesting. Do you think that you genuinely believed that that was the beautiful thing? Or do you think you wanted to believe it?
Wow, that's a really fascinating question. You know, it's hard because there were months where I really believed it. Like, okay. I literally have a photo of me going like this, and I was like really big, and I'm like, oh, I wasn't wearing like weird clothes, thank goodness, yeah. But it was still like, I felt like I was pretty for a second. So I do think I had moments where I really genuinely thought I was beautiful. And I will say, I think the content I was consuming of the body positivity movement telling me that it's okay and beautiful definitely contributed to me thinking and believing it was truly okay.
Where were you mostly seeing that? Was it a specific platform?
It was mostly TikTok and Instagram.
Interesting.
Yeah. It wasn't on YouTube or anything else.
Interesting.
And I had a lady the other day, she said, oh, well, that's just your algorithm. It's because you wanted to see it. And I'm like, no, I was a fat person. I didn't want to see fat people loving themselves. Like, why would an algorithm randomly show me that? You know, I'm not going to go too much into that. But I mean, it was concerning to me when she said that, because it's like, she's like, oh, well, my algorithm isn't like that. And I'm like, okay, that doesn't matter. The fact that there is an algorithm that's promoting obesity and glorifying it is a problem. Like, why can't we talk about that?
I think for your generation, there's less of a separation between what's real and what's virtual.
Yeah.
For me, it's really distinguished. Mm-hmm. But for your generation, it's really not.
Yeah.
Were you bewildered by
completely
all of this? Because again, it's generationally, you get these generational shifts, and I think now because of the technology and the internet and social media, they're perhaps starker than ever. So I'm a millennial. I'm kind of the last generation who will clearly remember the world pre-internet, smartphones, and social media, as well as the world after it. My life has pretty much been sort of 50-50. Mm. But I'm very aware when I talk to people who are in their early 20s or younger that they came of age. They have no memory of, oh, what it was like not having these tools and not having, you know, I didn't have social media in my teens. We didn't have smartphones in my teens and whatever. So I'm at that sort of interesting age where you can see and you felt some of the changes, but you didn't come of age when all this weird stuff was going on. So when I talk to people about, when I'm talking to young people and they've got YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and all of these apps and everyone's got smartphones and they're in school, it's that already is just very different to my school influence. Because when all that stuff became popular, I was already an adult. Mm. And I think you're then at least, if you've been raised well, you're hardwired to deal with it differently. And like you said, you have more of that separation. You can learn how to use the new tools and take advantage of them for your business or career or whatever, but you're less likely to kind of get totally sucked into it to a point where it becomes your basis for reality.
And her generation was, I think, the first generation to be influenced by it. So they're the test. You know, we didn't really know what was going to happen.
And
we tried to protect you from, you know, what was happening there. But, you know, how many fake accounts did you have? We lost track. And yeah, it's really challenging. And then, you know, and when you cut the internet off, it's like cutting oxygen off and then taking the phone away. Apparently, it wasn't appropriate that I would take the phone away to punish.
How old were you when you got a smartphone?
Oh, mom knows this better than me.
Four.
Oh.
I mean, four is probably when you weren't that interested in it until you were like eight, but you had one.
Four.
You definitely had one. Yeah, you would even like look at books and you'd like try to swipe, oh, wow. You know, and it was like you're like, no, the books don't swipe, you know, because kids can maneuver, wow, these devices. But as much as we tried to protect, I mean, I was concerned because I couldn't get through. And I'm like, am I the one that's crazy? Like, why isn't the therapist doing something? Why isn't the doctor doing something? Like, why isn't, you know, why can't I get through? Like, she was completely indoctrinated.
Wow. In hindsight, do you think that was a bad idea?
I think we have to learn how to manage the tool, like, yeah, you said. I don't know exactly what the solution is, to be honest, because it's like there's so much.
Yeah.
And parental controls are getting way better.
Yes.
The filters and whatnot. You can, I mean, I there was just the first, yeah.
She had a parental control on my phone, and I would try to go on my phone, and it was literally, everything was blocked. Apps, like, I couldn't even use my phone. Yeah. There was nothing to use except for the flashlight.
I'm leading this conversation because I think, again, a new and very important question, I think. I'm not a parent yet, but I talk to a lot of people on my podcast, and I think, okay, what do you think is the right age for a child or minor to get access to a smartphone and social media?
14.
You think 14? What do you think, Penelope?
For a kid?
Just a person, a human.
18.
Okay. That's interesting.
18.
I actually think it's interesting you said 18, you said 14. Yeah, from my 15 plus years use of social media, I think 16 to 18. I think 16 to 18.
You understand etiquette. You understand, yeah, how the world works. You understand what you're interested in. You've already had some exposure to what, you know, sex means, what it is, you know, and, yeah, there's that and the other.
I think because I've used social media so much, I think I'm hyper aware of the positives and hyper aware of the negatives. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen stuff on there that I think most people are not even aware is really a threat. Like, I think a lot of parents, most parents don't use social media a lot, right? Maybe they're a bit on Facebook or whatever, but they don't see the dangers of it. They don't know how much gnarly, weird.
I didn't.
So, yeah, there's, it's dark. Like, each platform has its darkness and strange rabbit holes that people can go into or get pulled into. And I'm, because of what I do, I'm very aware of all that. So when someone talks about like giving their like 8-year-old a smartphone, I'm like, no, like, that's great. I'm like, I'd rather take them to see an R-rated movie. That's going to be less damaging.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's such a brave new world. It's such a strange time. Penelope, talk me through the process of coming out of this. So getting up to, you said 320 pounds.
Yeah.
And then you had a realization a few years ago and you were like, all right, I want to take action.
Yeah. Well, the pattern before that was like eating a bunch of junk food and then vomiting and then maybe not eating for 2 weeks and, wow, then going back to binge eating every day, ordering out food, hiding it from my mom, which I got really tired of doing that because I'd have to hide it in my closet and then she'd find it. And then we talk about all the money that I stole and I have to start paying that money back, which means I had to get a job. So then I got a job and I had to start paying it back. And I was like, gosh, like, it's hard to work and be fat and to like also hate myself. Like, these three things together suck. And I also don't feel good. Like, now I'm like really feeling the side effects of like vomiting every weekend and then like, you know, starving myself on the weekdays. Like, I have no energy. So it was a very toxic pattern I was putting myself through. And so it's like, okay, so now I need to get to the root cause of why I'm eating. Now, why am I binge eating all the time? Why am I doing this? Well, one, I hate my mom at the time. I hated her. So I wanted to rebel against her because, okay, so this is interesting. So she's so beautiful. She's so perfect. And
she's looking at you like,
my whole life. But this is the thing. My whole life, I was always a little overweight and I was always really struggling with that. Like, literally at the age of 6, I like the huge bags of goldfish. Like, I ate a whole box at my friend's house. Like, that's how young it started, okay, because all we had in our house was flax seeds and chia seeds. You know, that was like our home, which is great. I'm so grateful for you. Thank you for not giving me processed GMOs. But, you know, I really struggled as I got older because I wanted to rebel against her because she kind of hated herself. And I saw her look in the mirror and pick on herself and say like, oh, I'm kind of ugly or I don't look good today. And I was like, I hate the way I look because I hate the way I look. And you look amazing and you hate yourself even though you do yoga every day. And you tell me I'm pretty. How could I ever believe you when you're telling me that I'm pretty, but you don't like yourself. You must think I'm really ugly and be lying to me if you don't think you're pretty and you think I'm pretty. Because it just didn't make sense to me. And the more she hated herself, the more I hated myself. Not that it's her fault, but I just, that was the pattern I followed as I grew up. And I was like, okay, well, I hate myself. There's nothing I can do. There's no, there. I didn't think at the time there was anything I could do to be a smaller, prettier version of myself. And I just never thought I was pretty. And I also had like a bad relationship with my father at the time. So I also hated him. So I never let him in my life to teach me anything or show me anything because I had this negative narrative about him. So once I started to realize like maybe I should spend time with my dad. Maybe he's not the worst person. Maybe I shouldn't let myself be me too. You know, maybe I should actually spend some time with him. And slowly I realized, okay, I can get out of this, but I have to work really hard on a bunch of different areas in my life. And it took me a lot of tears and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to realize all of that. So the first step I took was actually the method when I was 11. I decided with my mom, I was like, Mom, why doesn't everyone just step it up? And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, they just go from a double cheeseburger one week to a single cheeseburger the next, to a turkey burger the next, and then turkey burger on lettuce bun, and then a salad. Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah, like that makes sense. Like, that's a great idea. And I was like, yeah, because then, you know, I saw all the diets failing people. And I was like, this just sucks. Like, you shouldn't have to drink water for your life or eat salmon every day only to lose weight. And, you know, there should be some real way to sustainably lose weight. And so I ended up taking that advice from my younger self, because I tried keto, I tried Weight Watchers, paleo, you know, I tried every diet. I tried HCG injections, which made me so sick.
HCG, what's that?
It's like a hormone that they use for pregnant women, actually, that they have, that they use for women to suppress their appetite. So I was eating 800 calories every day, injecting myself, and I lost a lot of weight. Then I gained it all back.
Gotcha.
So I'd always lose weight and then gain it all back, because these weren't sustainable tools for weight loss. These were programs that want to benefit off of your money, but then don't actually want to help you, because you always fail and want to go back. So I decided to go from Burger King, which is what I was eating every day. I had like two double cheese bacon burgers with two things of French fries and a milkshake. And I know, right? I couldn't believe I could down all that. That's crazy. It's a lot. And then I went to Chipotle. So I just started eating Chipotle burritos every week. And then slowly from Chipotle burritos, I went to a Chipotle bowl with rice. Mm-hmm. And then I eliminated the rice. And then the next thing you know, I'm eating, you know, tons of vegetables, of chicken and beans. And like, I'm good now. Like, I started actually slowly losing weight. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It wasn't miserable or torturous. And I just did 1 hour of exercise every day that I loved. That was fun. So I wasn't just on the treadmill for an hour. No, I was actually moving my emotions, which is very interesting, because I saw all these workout programs and tried them, but they weren't fun. I was like, ugh, working out. But then I did these more emotional regulation workouts, which actually helped me move my emotions.
What does that mean?
It means that when you're doing a jumping jack, you kind of like, let's say you're doing like this, you like kind of release anything you may have. So like if I'm angry, I'll release it with like my hands, like kind of like emotion. Like when you go like this, you're pushing someone away. That's kind of what it was. Like, it's just kind of like a dance exercise, cardio.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, it's in principle, it's really easy to lose weight. Mm-hmm. But it isn't, because we have such a huge problem. 1 in 3 children are now obese.
It's 1 in 3 now.
It's 1 in 3. Like in 2028, they expect 43.5% of the population to be obese.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a real problem for insurance companies, for us. It's expensive. It's a problem. And so I think that the psychological and emotional regulation is a huge part of this equation that isn't really being addressed with just food and fitness. And so Penelope heard me with eating these crazy workouts, and it's really like intentional. Like, you go in and you're like, okay, I had to be buttoned up for my work and my life, you know, but you know what? This conversation didn't complete. This didn't work out in business. This relationship failed. The life, you know, all the things that happen for all of us. Yeah. And then what do you do with those emotions? Well, people who are obese are usually eating them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They wear their heart on their sleeve and they're stuffing it down, and then they're obese. And so Penelope heard me in the morning. She's like, what is Mom doing? Like, it was crazy. And then so then she joined me. Like, our first like really big breakthrough was just having dinner at the table.
Yeah.
Because she refused to eat my food. And oh, really? I'm like, a gourmet chef.
Your food is amazing. I am still so sorry that I've rejected your food my whole life.
And I'm like on my knees in the kitchen, like my own daughter won't eat my food. Like, what's wrong? You know, I could heal her. But regardless, this movement thing, it was a really, really big part of the puzzle. And there were times where she gave up and she walked out, times she was sobbing and had like a really big breakthrough. And so you bring your attention to it and you're really clear about what you're working with. Mm-hmm. Let the body take over because the body has the wisdom. The mind will lie to you all day. And then you really work it through. And I think women especially need a practice like this. Yeah, you're going to get tight, you know, a tight ass. You're going to get a six pack. Great. But more than that, you're going to like clear and move your emotions. Yeah.
There are so many interesting directions we can go. I was wondering, Helene, as Penelope was telling that story, what was all that like from your perspective?
I mean, I'm seeing it in my mind.
Okay.
I'm seeing that trip in Hawaii when she wanted the ice cream that the other girls were getting. And then afterwards, she wanted me to buy her fudge. And I had a breakdown. Mm. I'm like, how can I enable you and have to deal with your social anxiety and still be the one buying you the ice cream and buying you the fudge? And I'm like, no. And then if I don't, then I am, you know, a horrible mother who's abandoning her daughter and who's you know.
Is that what you were worried about, or is that what you were worried
about?
Well,
her therapist also, you know, and like, and her doctor. And like, you know, I'm thinking like, because I'm working with them and I'm like, you know, come on, guys, like, what's the plan here? Because I don't know what to do. I mean, I was an obese young woman. Mm-hmm. And I understand what it's like. I didn't get to the extent that Penelope got to, but so I'm just remembering all those moments, and I'm also remembering the agony and the tears and the screaming. You know, like I remember like being at your door. You know, it's dark in there, and I know God knows what she's doing. And I'm like holding the door, and she's big, you know, tall, she's strong,
300 pounds,
and I'm like holding the door, you know, and she's like trying to slam it, and I'm like no. Like, no, she's not going to close this door. And I'm like, I might lose my nose. I might break my face. Like, it was so, I took all of my might to be like, this door is not closing. Yeah. And just the desperation of it all. And I know that our situation is not unique. And the help that I could find was not there. Mm. And we had money, and we had, you know, we had access. We had like top doctors, top people. But this eating, the nutritional psychology is like a new field. Mm. And people don't understand that it's like this snowball effect because of the chemicals in the food. Mm-hmm. And because of, like you said, the cheap food. Like, it's so much more expensive to buy broccoli than it is, you know, a hamburger or, you know, some other very inexpensive food that's going to cause cancer and diabetes and heart disease eventually. And it's a really, really tricky problem to solve. And of course, I'm thinking that way because this is happening to her, I'm helping thousands of people lose weight and get fit and get healthy. And it's like, I felt like, I didn't feel like a fraud, but I felt so like, how can I help her?
Yeah.
And I felt really helpless. And I knew I did everything I possibly could.
Yeah.
You did kind of scam me though when you told me I was pretty and then told
no,
me
I always exercise. Thought you were pretty.
But that's the thing. That's the whole body positive thing. Like, let's just be honest, Mom. I was not pretty when I was 320 pounds.
The thing I'm embarrassed about is I like bribed you to lose weight.
No, I think
that's shamelessly great. Bribed her.
Yeah,
how so? she set up a chart and she was like, okay, 10 pounds, $10 in a new dress. 20 pounds, $20 in a new dress.
Okay.
30 pounds and, you know, you get like 30 extra dollars, okay. You know? And I think this is a great system. You know, if your child...
Like, it worked.
Yeah.
I was like, I'll pay you to swim. I'll give you $300 a season. I was like, come on, tennis, volleyball, anything.
But this is a great system to me. Like, why aren't more moms doing that? That is a great system. That's a great work. System. Kids want money sport. And they want to buy cute things. It's true.
This conversation is so fascinating to me because on one hand, it totally makes sense. And on the other hand, it's like so bizarre and strange and foreign to me. This is not PC at all, but I don't run a politically correct show. And I was just having a conversation with my girlfriend today on a little bit of this, but like a slightly different topic. And I was saying, I think one of the big things in modern Western society is that almost nobody tells women the truth.
This is true.
Women are lied to constantly. Women are lied to by men. Women are lied to from other women. If you're a man, you get very real-time, honest feedback on most things. If you're a guy and you're underperforming, women will tell you. Men will tell you. The world will tell you. The media, like, there's not a lot of that. I mean, perhaps one could say an absence of compassion, but I'd say there isn't the. I think there's less enablement, and there's just less lies. I think that just due to a range of different factors and the way that the two sexes are different, and the way that we process things, and the way that people communicate, the way men communicate with men communicate with women communicate with each other, these differences. Like, I find it fascinating, just the simple thing that the whole fat acceptance, body positivity thing. I've been saying this for over a decade, that it's such a glaring red flag to me that it's always aimed at women.
Yeah.
I just think that in itself is quite fascinating. Yeah. Do you think that the body positivity movement, for lack of a better term, do you think overall it's been a net good or a net bad for women?
Bad. It's been bad for women. Yeah. It's been bad for me. It's been bad. I've had people message me before being like, oh my gosh, thank you for speaking the truth about this movement. I didn't understand how it was harming me until I saw your video, or until I saw you speak about it, or your story. Like, it really inspired me, because I actually believed that I was pretty for a moment in time. And then I realized that I was really unhealthy, and that I didn't feel good, and that I needed to lose the weight. And no one was telling me it was okay to do that. Everyone was just telling me that it was fine to be overweight, that there was nothing wrong with it, mm-hmm. which meant I didn't need to change anything. And I think it's harmed women. And also, you're right, it actually ruins marriages, and it also harms relationships. And so if your man isn't telling
it makes,
you
and it makes it harder to find a relationship to begin with,
right? And it makes it harder for people to have kids. Yep. I mean, that's like, oh yeah, anyway, I could go.
I mean, I see it not absolute as good or bad. I think that, taken in context with the right amount of discernment, that it could be a very positive thing. I mean, when Penelope told me about body positivity, I'm like, oh yeah, you should be positive about your body. Mm-hmm. Right. But where it's gone, just like permissive parenting,
yeah.
is a problem, mm-hmm. because it's used as an excuse to not lose the weight, yes. and to pretend like everything's fine when it's not. And it's masking the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get into trouble, just like anything. And so on the one side, if you don't love yourself enough, you won't actually make the changes that are required to stick to a weight loss plan and to actually get healthy. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, like, shame and hate and blame are not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's good or bad. It's that it's just gotten out of hand.
I do think you have to have enough shame and hate to actually make a change. Because if you have no shame and hate and you don't think there's anything wrong, how are you supposed to move forward?
I'd agree. That's closer to how I
think. Thank you. I was just talking to a weight lady the other day. She's like, no, shaming is bad. That's, you should never believe in that.
Yeah. No, shame. It's about where it's applied. You know, I think one of the issues we're having in so many conversations is just like the black white false dichotomies, with something either being has to be all the way there or all the way there. So there are so many of these terms where it's not even that the concept is totally wrong, but the way that it's actually applied and the results of it are a net negative. So the idea of someone loving themselves or feeling positive about their being is generally good. It's a bit like the word pride. There's multiple forms of pride. There's a form of pride, which is narcissism. You stare at yourself in the mirror all the time and how beautiful you are, and you're super vain and all that. There's another sense of pride, which just means you're proud of your accomplishments or things you've done and achieved, or you feel comfortable in your own skin, or you feel happy to be a woman or being American or whatever it is. It's all the same word, pride, that's used, but it doesn't all mean the same thing. So I've said before, I think I had a tweet where I said, you know, real body positivity is eating right, exercising regularly, and taking care of your body and your lifestyle. To me, that's actual body positivity.
It is.
Not just, hey, whoever you are, whatever state you're in, however unhealthy you are, however fat you are, you're fine, you're healthy, you're beautiful, you're amazing. That's not, to me, that's just fake. That's just lying.
It's lying.
And I think once you're lying, then it's, I think actually that's quite a good barometer. I think that once you start telling lies, to even if it's under the guise of wanting to be compassionate or nice or whatever it is, I think you're entering, I think you've entered bad territory. I don't even think it matters what that comes under the umbrella of. I think once you're lying to people, intentionally lying to people and just saying things that are not true, then yeah, it's no longer on the side of good.
And then they start to attack and retaliate that those people who are calling out the lie are fat phobic all of a sudden.
I'm happy to take that one.
Which is not true either.
Yeah, or against diet culture or like toxic diet culture.
And being pro-health and pro-longevity. Yeah. You know, those are apparently, you know, anti-body. It's just so fascinating.
It is fascinating. I also wonder what percentage of people this really comes from, because we're all internet people to some degree. We exist in the real world, but we also spend a lot of time on social media. And with a lot of these ideas or movements or ideologies, I often wonder what percentage of the population is really into that. So say the whole, you can be healthy at any size, fat is beautiful, body positivity, fat acceptance, whatever. What percentage of the population is that really? You can get this weird thing on the internet due to the algorithms where it can seem like, oh, everybody thinks this way, or this is super common or popular or whatever. It could be some fringe view that 5% of people or even 1% of people hold, but the internet can make it look like it's 30, 40, 50, 60% of the population. And I think it's interesting not just to, I think what people do and how people behave says a lot more about what they truly believe than the sort of lip service they give things. And when you see that in action, it becomes very clear what people actually believe. That's what I was thinking in your own story when you're talking about how you're.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So-called friends or acquaintances responded to you both when you're gaining weight and then after you lose weight. To me, that kind of says it all, really.
Right. And it's funny because when I was being bullied in school, there were a lot of men who would bully me in school.
Men would bully you.
Men would bully me, which is good. I'm glad I was bullied. Yeah. I always say, like, I'm glad I was bullied and fat shamed in school because it was like the best way to build me to understand I had a problem.
How did guys bully you?
They were just like, oh, you're fat, you're ugly. They just shouted in the hallways. And I'm like, I look back and I'm like, oh, I'm so glad you guys did that. You guys are like, you guys helped me see the truth.
Men will tell the truth.
I know. And they will. I'm glad. And I'm so glad there. And people, when I say that, people are like, that's crazy. Like, how could you be a stand for that? I'm like, I'm a stand for the truth. They told me the truth. Bullies telling me the truth, that's a good thing. And it built me up to realize I had an issue.
They say that we have the ones who have a perception problem, that we hate ourselves because we want to have a certain body type that has, you know, less impact on our joints and that is considered healthy within a range. The BMI isn't even true anymore. And I think it is a smaller population, but I do think people are using this as an excuse to avoid getting healthy and dealing with the difficult thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, reclaiming your health. And it doesn't take long, but it does. There is a period where it's a little rocky.
Yeah. A lot of it, I think, is just a lot of it is cope and projection. I think that when people give you, I mean, I don't know all the types of criticism that you both deal with doing what you do online, but I know that it has nothing to do with you. That's the reality of it. When people get mad at that kind of stuff, or they start being nasty and they start leaving sort of type of comments, listening, they're just telling on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I get asked a lot, oh, Zuby, how do you deal with hate on the internet or criticism or this or this or this? I'm like, most of it, 90% of it has nothing to do with me.
Right.
There's just people who are out there. It could be men or women. They're angry. They're disgruntled. They're not happy with who they are and what they're achieving or what they're not achieving or their whole situation. I can't psychoanalyze all the billions of people in the world. And then you just become the target for whatever stuff that they're not dealing with. So you're kind of holding up a mirror, I think, particularly with your weight loss. If you improve and there's a before or after, especially if it's something that's visual and people can just see it, then it's holding up a mirror to everyone else. Because if the whole PSYOP is, hey, there's nothing that can really be done about obesity, and if you're overweight, like it's just how you are, it's your genetics, it's the chemicals in the food, it's this, it's whatever, it's anything but you and your lifestyle and your choices. And then someone is like, oh, hey, I was like this, and this is me now. It just blows up that entire narrative, because it shows people, oh, actually, if I took personal responsibility and accountability, and I did clean up my diet, and I did exercise regularly, and I did do all those things I probably already know that I'm supposed to be doing, I could actually cure this so-called disease.
Yeah,
this isn't like a cancer or a cold or a flu or something that just happens to you. It's a process due to choices, and it can be reversed due to choices. We've already said there's things that make it more difficult, for sure. But even if you just look at the microcosm of the USA. Okay, so USA now, adult obesity rate is somewhere around 40%. But that means 60% of adults are not obese. And it's not a sort of traditionally contagious disease that, you know, you just bump into someone and you catch it. So while I agree with a lot of the statements that are made and the criticisms of the food supply and the advertising and algorithms and this and this and this, I'm like, okay, well, everyone's being exposed to... That's the case for everybody. So if there are people who can be in those environment and shop at those same grocery stores and eat at the same place and do all these same things, yet they're not catching this magical new disease, this tells me that, okay, yeah, there might be some problems in the system. We can acknowledge that. But also, it ultimately comes down to you as an individual and what you're going to do. I could sit there all day and complain about all the stuff. I can complain about the chemicals. I can also just make better choices. Because one crazy thing in the States is, I mean, I've been to the grocery stores here. They're huge. And all the options are available. There's the... You can buy the most unhealthy, unnatural, chemically altered garbage, but you can also, in the same store, sometimes in the same aisle, you can also find, oh, wow, there's fruits and vegetables and meat and rice and potatoes and all these type of things. And I'm sure you guys do this too. When you go shopping, do you look at what's in people's carts?
All the time.
Look at what
I find
they look
it fascinating.
Like.
I study it. I love doing that. Yeah. But I almost feel like it is their fault. It's a responsibility, but okay. It may not be their fault because they weren't taught by their parents. I think the breakdown of the family unit is a big culprit in this equation. Without a father in the house, with two parents who are working, like the parents didn't really teach kids how to cook. Mm. And then home economics now is considered, you know, not okay, right? So there isn't home economics in school anymore to teach you how to sew and cook. And so your doctor doesn't have time to teach you about lifestyle medicine, which would be food, which they're not educated in, nutrition, and they're not educated in, or they're not, their model, the business model for doctors isn't to help you learn about fitness. And going to a gym may not be possible for everybody. So I feel like the information people are getting is so varied, and they're so overwhelmed now as well at the grocery store, on the internet. Like, how the heck do I lose this weight? They have so many options, and they don't know what works. They don't actually know. I mean, to a certain degree, people have an idea, but that's not fun, and that's why diets don't work. It's not fun. Like, you get bored of eating just salmon and salad every day, or, you know, whatever it is. And I think that it's not their fault, and it's their responsibility.
That's interesting. I'm interested by that statement. I'm being philosophical here. You said you think it's their responsibility, but not necessarily their fault.
Education in this country especially is a huge problem. And I think it's the family's responsibility.
Okay.
But the families, for the most part, aren't really taking ownership of that.
How, and I'm not trying to, like, press here. I'm just curious. when do you think that excuse or line of thinking expires? Like at what age?
24, maybe?
24. Okay.
22?
Because I totally agree for children. If you're talking like kids, then yeah, kids are not generally making their own food choices.
Once they're
eating whatever. But with many things, there's an age where, especially in this internet era, where we live in the age of, when I meet a 30-something-year-old who's like, oh, I don't know how to cook, I'm like, there's no excuse for that.
No. It's a survival skill.
Like, you can go on YouTube right now
and learn how to cook.
You can learn how to cook today, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It, you know, if your parents didn't teach you or whatever, I get that. But I'm like, bro, you've had like 20 years of being able to learn this. And
it's essential. But when you're on that cycle, your taste buds are trained, your microbiome is trained, your brain is trained, it's not that easy to switch out of it. But I agree with you. Everyone absolutely needs to learn how to cook. And if you don't know how to cook, it's a problem for your longevity, for your health, and your future, unless you're very rich and you can source food from organic, non-GMO, using good oils and salt, like kind of restaurant. And they're very few and far between. We live in the mecca of health right here. And there are only like two restaurants, maybe three, that we would go to.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd imagine you're way more picky with food than I am.
We like never go out, ever, because we know how bad the food, the oils are and the processed foods. And
sometimes it's better to know less.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's sometimes when it comes to nutrition stuff, I often don't get too much into the weeds because most people don't have the basics right. So when it comes to the conversations about, I don't know, certain additives or if it's seed oils or if it's this or if it's that, I get all that and I think it's important. But when it comes to obesity and people just eating, like most people are just eating too much. People are consuming too much. So until people can even master like basic macronutrients and portion control and not over consuming all the time. I think what happens sometimes, in my personal opinion, is I see this on X, app formerly known as Twitter, particularly, and even on YouTube, is people get completely lost in the weeds before they've got the basics. So you've got someone who doesn't know how to, you know, the difference between protein, carbs, and, you know, and fats, or how much they need to be eating, or the basics of, they don't know the basics, and then they're getting confused because they're seeing people there preaching about carnivore and plant-based and seed oils and like this, these, they're like much more things that are more advanced, essentially. And then they're just like, oh my gosh, there's this guy who's telling me that eating steak is going to give me cancer and destroy my gut. And this person's saying, no, you shouldn't eat plants.
Yep.
And then this person is saying seed oils are the devil. This person's saying, no, actually seed oils are okay in moderation.
Right.
And this person's saying you shouldn't eat after 6 p.m. This person's high carb. This person's low carb. Yep. And they're just, gosh. And I think sometimes people end up doing nothing. So with me, when I give advice, if I'm talking to someone who's already like super versed in nutrition and they're already healthier, then it can be a different conversation. If it's just someone who's sitting there and they're just, poof, you know, they're huge, then it's just like, okay, it's to step it up. It's a, okay, your diet right now, what you're eating, what you're drinking, like it's all bad. So let's go bit by bit. We're probably not going to get you, boom, immediately onto some super, like, ultra, ultra perfect diet.
Step by step.
Yeah,
there's people surprised, though.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't eat too much. A lot of people aren't eating.
You don't think?
Well, a lot of people I speak to are just living on cafe, like coffee, until about 2 p.m. And then they eat one meal.
Okay.
No, but they've already destroyed their metabolism.
Okay.
By extreme dieting, you know, eating too much and then not enough. Like what Penelope was doing, she was eating, she was like binging, and then she would stop eating for 2 weeks. And that yo-yo dieting starts to harm your metabolism. Gotcha. Some people, though, are totally out of control and they're eating like 4 burgers a day, one meal at a time. But believe it or not, the majority of people I speak to actually are really, they know they have a problem. Mm. They're feeling really guilty about it, and they don't actually eat that much. And then they're broken, kind of.
Interesting.
Not they are broken, but their metabolism is broken, and it takes time to heal that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm sure, you know, we'll talk to different people. The majority of people I've ever helped in this regard, it's just overconsumption.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, just not even knowing. I'll tell you, I'm often careful not to say it's just like eating too much. I tend to say consuming.
Mm.
Because so many people drink 600, 700, 800, 900,000 plus calories per day. I know. And they don't even notice it.
Yeah,
it's true.
These people are going to like Starbucks and they'll drink some milkshake. It's like 600. Yeah. They'll go to Starbucks in the morning and then they'll have like a milkshake at lunch and then they'll have like a Coke and they've consumed 200, 300, 400 grams of sugar like just drinking, just in the drinks. And then you add alcohol, like people who drink a lot of alcohol. Like I've come across people who they drink more calories than they eat.
Yeah, that's so true.
That's not even that rare.
This is an easy fix too.
Very easy fix. Very
love
easy fix. I was talking to somebody the other day. He's like, yeah, you know, I drink like 10, 12 cans of Coke a day. Like, or in the States, especially because you get those big gulps and there's the infinite refills.
Yeah.
Because I can just be in a restaurant and I try not to be like weird and nosy, but sometimes I just kind of, I observe the environment around me.
Yeah.
And I'll just see someone, like I'll watch with my own eyes someone just consume 300 grams of sugar in a sitting. And I assume that they don't even realize that they just did that, right? They'll get the big gulp. The giant container, they all fill it up, you know, they'll drink a couple liters worth, like full fat, right? Full sugar, whether it's Coke, Sprite, whatever it is, and they're having their dessert and they're just having that, and then they'll get their Starbucks and they'll get there. And I was like, man, that is a lot of...
It's just as addictive as cocaine.
Mm.
Sugar.
Yeah.
It shifts your neurobiology into the addictive brain like we were speaking about earlier, and it is like cocaine. It is so addictive. Mm. And it also affects your immunity. I mean, you get your immune system tanks. Like if you think you're susceptible to disease anyway because you're obese, I mean, eat sugar and then see what happens. Mm-hmm. It increases your inflammatory response. And so it's a precursor, of course, to all those diseases related to inflammation, which are chronic pain, autoimmune disorders, you know, cancer, heart disease, of course, and diabetes is the biggest one.
Yes. Talk more about the dangers and addiction of sugar.
I look at it as a non-reciprocal relationship because when you eat sugar, it only takes from you. It doesn't give anything to you. And if you look at the industry behind sugar, it's highly regulated. And it is, in my opinion, sinister.
Okay.
And they have, like, the sugar industry has these drink manufacturers really, like, as a stronghold. I mean, they can literally change the price from one day to the next and put people out of business. It's so fascinating. Okay. But it's also very intelligent. I mean, I'm a capitalist. I believe in making money. But when you put your health in the hands of industrialized food complex, when you're eating processed foods that are everything has sugar in it, when you start to put sugar on your radar, it's in every sauce, it's in every prepared food, it's in every drink. When you first start to like avoid it, you're like, what? There's nothing I can eat. It's in everything because it keeps you hooked in. So it's great for a business model, but it's not great when you're putting your health, you know, in opposition to it. Mm. And so it's a huge problem, I think.
Yep.
And if you want to start somewhere with your health, get off sugar.
Okay.
Just make it like non-negotiable because to me, it's not a negotiable relationship. You're either on it or you're off it. There's no in between. I have worked with thousands of people, and the ones that try to keep that in between, it's just like torture.
It's interesting.
It keeps you in a stronghold of addiction, and it's shocking. And people who are in the addiction, they know it. They're like, oh, I gotta eat less sugar. Like, oh, they wake up, they feel hungover. They haven't been drinking necessarily, but they just feel hungover. And you have this chronic inflammation, which causes premature aging, wrinkles, those diseases related to aging, like heart disease and diabetes, of course. You tire out your pancreas, you know, your pancreas will...
Do you not have any sugar at all?
I have fruit.
Okay.
I do eat fruit in moderation, and I occasionally will make like a homemade chocolate. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
It's really good.
So good. And I make it with dates. Okay. But that's still fruit.
Yeah. Honey or...
Honey sometimes, like when I'm sick, okay. I will definitely take some honey, but it's not like in my, if we put it in our dressing sometimes, mm-hmm. our salad dressings, but it's like really, really, really minor.
Okay.
Yeah.
No cane sugar though. We don't
eat. Oh no, there's no cane sugar in the house.
I actually remember when I was addicted to sugar, I had to detox off of it and I had really bad headaches. I literally felt like I was going through like a long hangover. Mm. I had the worst withdrawal symptoms. Do you remember how mean I was to you?
Oh, yeah. You have 3 days. If you're really addicted, you'll have 5 days. But once you're on the other side of it, it's like freedom and bliss. And it's just 3 days. You feel kind of achy, like you have a cold, really. Your body is just letting it go. Your body, it doesn't do much to your body. What's really interesting is that there's the bacteria in your gut crave it. And if you don't get, that's what gives you that strong desire to get more and more and more. And people need their hit. It's like every 2 to 4 hours. And if you don't get your hit, those bacteria get angry and you get angry and they die off eventually.
Okay. If you've already kind of gotten into an addiction.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It doesn't take long.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't take long to get on it. It doesn't take long to get off it. But there is a bit of a withdrawal period.
That's interesting. What role do you think that the government and or food companies, let me phrase this question correctly. What role should they play, and how much responsibility do you think lies with institutions, let's say, versus individuals and citizens? I ask this as well because I'm not from the USA. I'm from England. In the UK and in Europe in general, the food is generally different, but also the rules and regulations are different. So there are many additives, colorings, preservatives, things like that, which are totally legal to put in foods here, which are some of them outright banned in European countries, for example. And I myself, I'm not sure my exact position on this in terms of what regulations there should be or where the boundaries lie, but I'm curious to know what your thoughts on that are.
With 1 in 3 children considered obese today, mm-hmm. and the projection of that by 2028, 2034, we're dealing with a really big problem of 100% preventable diseases. With that in mind, and with COVID, what we really started to understand was that a lot of children get all of their food at school. Mm. And so as a first priority, like cleaning up the act of the government, what the government's providing for school food. You go into a school cafeteria in the United States, it's not a kitchen. It's like they just defrost food and take it out of the package and reheat it. Yeah. It's not a kitchen. There are organizations that have proof of concept to get in the door. It's a lot more logistics, but to get in the door, the same cost of a meal that is, you know, organically grown, that's in the region. There's all kinds of renovations and renewal programs that schools could implement if the government would get involved. And I think the government should get involved.
Yeah. Do you think that, man, whenever someone says the government should get involved, it like sets up a...
I know. No.
It flashes red light. But part of the reason...
True.
The part of it for me as well is like, I wonder, do... I don't think that the government necessarily is benevolent. Quite far from it. But I also wonder, do they themselves even know? Do they know the facts? If you're looking at so-called public health officials, or you're looking at the people who are in these organizations, whether it's the FDA or it's whichever these bodies are, I often wonder, do they, like, we know that a lot of doctors don't know much about nutrition, and they're doctors. Like, in my mind, a doctor should obviously know a lot about nutrition, but some of them, from what I've heard, only get a couple hours schooling in their entire medical school.
That's right.
So even if you had people who genuinely wanted to fix the problem and sort it all out, I mean, these are the same people who gave you the food pyramid, who told you to be eating, you know, 12 servings of grain of grain and carbs a day, and very, very small amounts of meat, and that saturated fat is terrible for you, and margarine is better than butter, and it's the same people, right?
It's so funny you say that, because when I was 300 pounds, my doctor told me to eat bread. Do you remember this? She said, you should start eating some more bread. And I was like, I'm 300 pounds, and you're telling me to eat bread? I would never in my life think to eat bread to lose weight. I would never do that.
It's 12 servings a day.
We lived in Switzerland for 10 years, dad and I. And we spent a lot of time in France and Germany and Greece. And the nutrition is completely different. Mm. And managing weight, you don't see obese people. I mean, you very rarely. I mean, England a lot more. Mm-hmm. And Switzerland, not so much.
Even in England, something I've noticed is the rate of people in England versus the USA who are overweight is not that different. But in the UK, it's rare to see someone who's like super obese. Mm. There's a type of person you see in America where you don't really see anywhere else. There's like a level where it's of morbid obesity, where it's just, you know, the kind of come out the car and get in the mobility scooter and start driving around Walmart. Like you do not see that in the UK at all.
And I think that you made a very valid point about the herbicides, fungicides, pesticides, genetic modification that you do, that's illegal in Europe. And that's completely legal here. And I think the chemical load and the toxic load in our food system is a huge problem. Mm. Should some of those things be made illegal? Perhaps.
Yeah.
And there are enough lawsuits now that are starting to correlate certain chemicals and herbicides, fungicides, and pesticides with cancer. Mm. And they've had to, you know, put a cap on what those lawsuits can bring in, because it just would put, you know, it would bankrupt some of these companies.
Wow. What do some of those chemicals actually do? Because
they don't know.
They don't actually know. Because I think oftentimes, even in nutrition world, people will talk about, you know, chemicals and this and that. But I'm curious, like, what's the actual... I can assume a lot of the stuff is bad, but I wouldn't know the actual mechanisms of, okay, this does this and this does that.
Well, we could go into it, but you know, how much time do we have? but I think the general idea is that we have to stay on top of our toxic load.
Okay.
All of us. And when you are overweight, you have a lot more toxicity in your body, because a lot of those toxins are stored in the fat cells.
Gotcha.
And so you're going to the gym, clearly. You're working out.
Hopefully it shows.
I am, you know, working out. I'm sweating as much as possible. Getting in the sauna. I'm doing like my thing. Actually, California is very dry, so I'm not sweating as much as I did when Florida. Yeah. But anyway, you need to get that out. Toxins come out through feces, urine, and sweat. So you've got to manage your toxic load. Right now, there isn't like an easy test. There are a bunch of different tests you can take to see where you are in the spectrum, but they're a little expensive. Insurance doesn't usually cover them. But a general rule of thumb is to stay well hydrated, sleep well. Eat, you know, organic food, even though it's not perfect. It's better than some of the conventional foods. You know, just ensure your source is clean, as clean as it can be. And just try not to drink a ton of alcohol and smoke cigarettes and, you know, just accumulate toxins. Now, you're traveling a lot, so you're accumulating more toxins. So for you to be on top of it, and people who are listening, we have to be mindful of it. Because when your DNA starts to mutate, which happens... And this is from the University of Oregon's research. This is not something that I'm just making up. Dr. Williams showed us his research on toxicology and chemo prevention through phytonutrient therapy. And what he showed us was that when the DNA has too much of a toxic load, then the DNA mutates and you get a carcinogen. You get metastatic cancer. Fascinating. So there's over 72,000 chemicals in the environment today. We only know what a fraction of them do. Many of them are carcinogenic.
Yeah.
And so we basically just need to take full ownership and responsibility of figuring out how to optimize our detoxification pathways through the liver, through the bladder, you know, through the skin, and so on and so forth.
Well, there's a lot of work to do. We've talked about what the obesity trend is doing, and I think it's important to say that this is not USA is sadly one of the world leaders in obesity, but it's not the only country. Most countries' obesity rates are just going up and up and up at all ages. What do you think? See, one of the hard things I find, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, and I think the honest answer might be that maybe there's not an answer. But I've been wondering for a long time. I know how to solve obesity at the individual level. If someone comes to me and they're overweight and they need to lose weight, they need to get in better shape, they want to build their muscles, whatever it is, I can help them. I know as long as they followed my advice, they would lose a lot of body fat, they'd get in better shape, and so on. I don't know how you scale that. I don't know how you scale that individual solution at a societal level. The answer might be, hey, maybe there's no way to do it unless without massively infringing on people's liberty and freedom. Because if people have liberty and freedom to consume whatever they want and as much as they want, and it's super available and it's highly advertised and it's super delicious, then a lot of people are going to do that. Increasing numbers of people are going to do that. And yes, you can have all the personal trainers and fitness influencers and nutritionists and dietitians and all of that out there as well. And that's also, both of these things are huge industries, but I don't know how you get that obesity wise. You know, it's gone from 5% to 10% to 20% to 30% to 40%. How do you get it to go back down to 30 rather than up to 50?
I think people need to really agree on what's healthy.
Okay.
I think right now there's so much disagreement about what actually healthy means. And then I think there needs to be a lot of money thrown at it. And like, you remember, like, all, there's like what the milk advertisements, and we all can remember like that milk
the mustache. Milk mustache got milk.
Right, milk went, you know, there's the, there are all these like public service announcements where groups of people were aligned on what was the right thing to do. Remember feeding the Ethiopian children for a while? That was like, you know, we are the world, we are the children. Like that made an impact. If people could agree and then money could flow and then public service announcements, marketing campaigns, making it fun, exciting, interesting.
Mass fat shaming.
You could do fat shaming. I mean,
I'm for the fat shaming.
Her face and her eyes just lit up there. The like, more yes, fat give me billboards.
The better. No, it's true. Fat shaming is good for people. It was really good for me. I think we should do more of it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, do you know the truth? Because people say fat shaming doesn't work. And I think the truth is it works on a lot of people. It doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
I think it's goofy when people say fat shaming doesn't work because I'm like, no, it absolutely does because it worked for me and it worked for millions, if not billions, of people around the world.
It works for me too. It works.
I think, again, it's the extreme thing. I'm not saying go out there and start like pointing at fat people on the street and bullying them and calling them names and don't be nasty to anybody at all. But I think with any self or societal destructive behavior, there should be some degree of shame or stigma around it. It doesn't matter what it is. The same with smoking. People shame smoke. Why? There's no, oh, you're horrible for smoking shaming, or if someone's binge drinking, if someone wants to shoot heroin or whatever, there's no, oh, no, you can't shame that person, or we need to glorify, you know, oh, you can be healthy no matter how much heroin. Like, that would be crazy to even say that. Obesity, let's be honest, obesity is, gosh, if not worse, it's probably at least equal to smoking.
Totally.
Yeah.
In terms of the
second most preventable disease in the world.
Okay. After
smoking.
Okay. So it's just, yeah, I mean, it would be, yeah, I mean, I'm not, again, with smoking shaming, I mean, it doesn't, again, I don't go up to people who are smoking and start like yelling at them or calling names or whatever. But if I had a friend who was developing a serious smoking, I'd be like, hey, bro, like, that's not good for you, man.
And that's okay. Like, I was talking to some overweight woman and they were saying that, like, I was like, okay, so if I have an 800-pound friend who's in bed and gonna die and they're like on their last days, I'm not supposed to talk about their weight, talk about their health, try to help them, try to eat healthy, do arm exercises in bed. Like, I shouldn't do anything. They're like, no,
yeah,
let them do them. And I'm like, okay, but if there was a heroin addict shooting up heroin, you would try to help your friend out, right? Or should we be posting that online? And they were like, oh, no. And I'm like, well, it's the same thing. Food is an addiction, and so is heroin, in any case when you're obese. And she was like, no, like, food is not an addiction. And I'm like, no, but it is.
Yeah.
And it's worse than heroin because you have to do it every day.
4 million people died last year from obesity.
4 million.
4 million.
In the U.S.? Is that in the U.S.?
Is it in the U.S.?
It might be worldwide.
I don't know, actually. We should check.
Worldwide, that number sounds too low.
Because it was the WHO that gave us that number.
Obesity-related.
So it must be global, I would think. The World Health Organization?
4 million, given there's 8 billion people, 4 million sounds low. If it's things... So I know per year, globally, about 60 million people die a year.
Okay.
And the top two causes are heart disease and cancers. And given the obesity connection to those two things, I'd be surprised if it's only 5 million.
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
In the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah, there we go.
In the U.S.
Just in the U.S., yeah.
The US.
That makes more sense. Yeah, that makes more sense then.
Ah.
That's horrible.
So getting to the root of it, I think, is really important. Yeah. And I don't think that we have a system for that at scale, for example. But I think to do it at scale, we'd have to have like a really collective approach.
Yeah. The problem is that the incentives are so misaligned. There's all the incentives to do the opposite.
Right.
That's the thing. Like, I always just think in terms of incentives. And while I agree with the ideal, but unless it was just like, okay, you know what? Let's take $10 billion and let's give it to like the gym bros on Twitter and like the body the body photos and those like fitness girls on in fitness influencers and whatever, like let's and then we'll just let them run or give it to like some military drill sergeants. Okay, let them decide what to do with it. Then I think it might be effective. But I think if it's just like, oh, let's give it to the usual folks, then you're just going to get up with Food Pyramid 2.0 and them buying lots of nice properties and giving kickbacks to their buddies at all these big food companies.
Agreed. I mean, you look at the hospital food, the school food, yeah. You know, food out. It's impossible to find good food. I mean, you travel, you know.
And I always say that obesity benefits everyone except the obese person. So it benefits the clothing industry, it benefits the pharmaceutical industry, it benefits the medical industry, it benefits therapists, but it doesn't benefit the person who's obese because they're going to pay more. They have to go to more visits. It's more expensive for them to eat more food, to need more clothes. And it just sucks.
And insurance and the diseases they're going to get.
Yeah.
And then the taxpayers, we're paying for them to be obese. We're enabling them.
This is a interesting question when it comes to, so again, being from the UK, you know, we have socialized medicine there. We have the NHS. So it's a rather different situation to, there's some socialized healthcare in the US, but it's not quite the same. And one reason why even, you know, some of my more left-wing friends or associates who are big on the healthcare for all sort of thing, it's like, dude, with just the percentage of people in the USA who are ridiculously unhealthy and 300 million plus people, you can't just take the model from Denmark or Sweden and slap it on to the USA. It will not work. You'd need tax rates to be like 70% of 70% income tax or something across everybody to even fund it, just because people are so unhealthy to begin with. So even from people with that perspective, it's still not implementable because the baseline level of health would just bankrupt. It would just bankrupt the entire thing. I have an idea as well, and I can't do this on my own, but I think that we as society need to change what even comes to people's brains when we say healthcare. Because I always tell people, when people are like, we need healthcare, I'm like, if you think about what that word sort of should mean, 90% plus of healthcare comes down to you. It's actually what you eat. It's your exercise or lack thereof. It's how much you drink or don't drink. It's how much sleep you're getting, what substances you're consuming. It's your own lifestyle factors. So by the time I need to go to a hospital, that's emergency healthcare. I take care of my own healthcare for the most part. It's like if I find myself in a hospital, I'm like, oh, something went wrong. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often, but it's because I'm doing my own healthcare day to day. And I think that also puts the personal responsibility mentally back onto the individual. It gives them the if people thought, oh, actually, healthcare is my responsibility. Okay, we need emergency healthcare for when stuff goes wrong with the body or with the mind or there's an accident or something. But I'm responsible for my own healthcare. And I think if people thought that way, instead of just outsourcing it to the government or some system or the pharmaceutical industry and doctors and this whole web, then I think it would actually adjust people's long-term behaviors.
100%. I've been thinking about this for a few decades.
Okay, cool.
That we should have well care.
Mm.
And that system should include the kind of support that is required. Because, you know, taking your own health into your own hands, sometimes you need supplements. Sometimes you want to go see the chiropractor. Sometimes holistic health care, lifestyle medicine, is not supported by the current sick care model. Mm. And it would be incredible to see something really take hold in our society where we could find those rewards that you're talking about and create rewards for people to take ownership. But I really think it comes back to education.
Yeah.
If people knew how easy it was, how delicious it could be, if people understood how simple it is and they understood the cycle of nature, which we've become so disconnected from, that our bodies were meant to heal themselves and rejuvenate, that it's so easy and fun, they might actually take ownership in a different way.
Yeah.
But I just see a huge disconnect, and I don't see it getting better. I see it getting worse, unless something like what you're describing, which to me would be, makes sense, just makes sense to have a well care system that rewards you for being healthy and penalizes you when you get sick. Mm-hmm. Yet there's this emergency carve out.
Yes. Yeah. I think maybe this is my, I've never articulated this on a podcast before. I just tend to think out loud as I'm talking. It's generally how I communicate. I think maybe this is where there's room for some optimism in terms of thinking about how that percentage eventually comes down, is maybe you get to a point in the country or across countries where, so there's two interesting things that are happening, which is that, yes, more than two, but obesity is rising, diabetes is rising, substance abuse is rising, depression is rising, you know, suicidal ideation, like there's a lot of bad health things mentally, physically, that are all rising. At the same time, more people than ever are interested in and participating in strength training and joining gyms and finding, you know, the supplement industry is growing, the nutrition industry is growing, the personal training industry is growing. People like myself, people like yourselves can build businesses, whether this is doing yoga or Pilates or classes or what, like all those industries and awareness are also growing. Mm-hmm. So maybe over the course of time, maybe we're still entering the valley, but it hits some type of inversion point where that latter group becomes more powerful, influential, interesting than the institutions and conglomerates that are getting people fatter and unhealthy and more depressed. And I think that one reason that might happen is because ultimately, human beings are aspirational. So as much as you push, you can be fat and healthy, or, you know, big, being morbidly obese is beautiful, or eat this garbage or eat that slop. Deep down at the core and in the soul, people know what health looks and feels like. So no matter how much you push the dad bod or you push the morbidly obese women on magazines or whatever, men will still aspire to have, you know, wide shoulders and six packs and look like He-Man, and women will still aspire to have certain body types to be attractive to men and whatever. Deep down, people know the truth and they aspire towards it. And so I think that, yeah, the battle's been going in this way for a while, but I think that could ultimately be the thing that causes the sort of mass shift. Maybe it'll get to 50-50. It'll get to half the population is obese and half is not. And then at that point, this tribe gains enough steam where it's like, oh, actually, this is what we need to be doing. And I think I'd like to be optimistic. And I guess if I think it through, I could see that's how it plays out, let's say, over the next century. And if it doesn't, then you'll end up in 2100 and like 95% of people are obese and you've just got like a weird fringe minority of like freaking jacked, super super healthy people who are all like breeding with each other. And then you've got have you seen WALL-E where they're sort of floating around in the chairs like with the drink? And I'd much prefer the former.
It takes a lot of courage to get healthy.
Yeah.
And what you just described, the human heart and having faith in that, I do too. And having the courage to really look at yourself in the mirror, which is what you had to do. She looked at herself in the mirror and she was like, this is not who I am. I don't recognize this person, but this is not who I am. And you're describing exactly that pivotal moment. I'll never forget it. It's like etched into my memory.
Yeah.
And that's the courage, the fire underneath the courage that shifts you into action. And we can call it shame, fat shaming, but we're doing it to ourselves. We know the truth and we know we can do better. And I think it's about achieving our potentiality, which is, you know, kind of a silly way to say it, but it's true. It's achieving our greatness, what we were put here to do and who we can be, and having that energy and vitality. There's nothing that's more valuable than that. Mm. You can't buy it and you have to work for it.
Absolutely.
And that courage is the traction. Mm. And it does. It takes a lot of courage to face your demons, to face your gluttony, to face your greed, and to face your addictions, and to face your habits that are leading you down a dark tunnel of hopelessness.
Yes.
Because really it's a pandemic of hopelessness.
Mm.
And our aspirational thinking is required for us to continue to see the greatness in all the people, the obese people, the people who have, let you know, maybe 40, 30 pounds to lose as well.
Yep.
Because there's always a next level. Even for us, like even though we're healthy, I still have.
We've all been fat.
Right on.
We've all been fat.
Yeah.
So again, that should be motivation for people, because we're not all sitting here as people who have been, you know, we've just been thick, stick thin our entire lives and eaten whatever we want and we still look great. And that's none of us. So again, it's like, yeah, you can do it. People do it by the millions and the billions. So yeah, you can go in this direction, but you can also go in the other direction. And I think maybe one more white pill is, if you think of the way the public situation and statistics have changed around smoking, for example, that's on a positive trend.
Yeah, that's true.
Far fewer people smoking now than in previous decades. I believe that fewer people are drinking excessive alcohol. It seems like the younger generation's actually drinking far less alcohol.
Probably vaping more.
Yeah, maybe vaping more, but vaping's probably better than...
Aren't they more into psychotropics?
I don't know. I don't know. we'll see. We'll see. Maybe it's like I said, it's the problem has only been around for a few decades.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very likely the long-term solution is going to take at least a few decades. Mm. Awesome. Elaine, Penelope, you're both awesome. Where can people find and follow you online?
You can follow both of us at Step It Ups on Instagram. You can follow us at Step It Up Podcast on YouTube. And you can follow us on Twitter, or X, now known as X, at Step It Ups with 3 S's at the end.
Awesome. And it's mostly young men that listen to this podcast, but a significant number of young women as well. If you can give one message to the ladies who are listening. Let's do a message for the women. What do you
For the woman. I love women so much. Okay. My one message for any woman out there who is struggling with obesity or being overweight or going up into that trajectory. Number one, there is hope. Number two, you can. And number three, resist the media and the lies that people will tell you to try to convince you that you have no problem and that it is totally fine to be overweight, because it's not. My grandmother died of obesity. I almost died of obesity, and I would never want that for you or anyone else in my life. And that's why I've dedicated the rest of our lives, you know, to helping people lose weight and keep it off for good without dieting, because I believe that it's possible. I don't believe that you need to do a restrictive diet for the rest of your life. And I do believe that it's a problem that you can solve by yourself.
I love what you said, Penelope, about there's hope, and our ability to trust our bodies when they failed us is really an important skill to develop. And you do that by following through. So trust your body again by setting a goal that's achievable and follow through. And then build that confidence, because that's where you're going to have the strength to carry on and continue. And I believe that we need each other. Woo.
Amen.
I believe that we need each other. And that support is required, whether it's your sister, your brother, your preacher, your neighbor, your friend, maybe not a girlfriend, I don't know, unless she's willing to lift you up. But we definitely have a program that can help. We have a low-end program. We have a high-end program. But wherever you can get it, just learn what the components of healthy living are. Your body will restore itself. It will heal itself. So there is hope.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.